regular at St. Helens, I hope you take our card. And if you've done that, you'll know that our title for tonight, January the 8th, is The Secret of Generosity. The Secret of Generosity. I must confess that I was responsible for the overall title of Secrets for the Christmas Vacation. And I feel a little guilty for that because I'm skeptical of secrets. There was once a series of books issued by World Books, and the two titles that took my eye were The Exam Secret and The Golf Secret. And in those days, you could get either of those books for about 25p in today's currency, and I bought them and found them signal failures. I read The Golf Secret through and through, but it made no difference to me, and I still come last in the staff golf day. I've forgotten what it was. It's something about pivoting on your hips. But as those books have long been out of print, I take it that that is not actually the golf secret. Certainly it hasn't satisfied the fans, and if you play golf at all, or hack your way around a course, you'll know that you've got a great deal to choose from in terms of instructional books, and even sort of instructional cartoons in the daily paper. There's one by Gary Player, which I always think is almost funnier than Garfield. Gary has a fellow called Ian that he plays with, and Ian must be a complete rabbit or a complete fool, and he always asks questions which are very easy for Gary to answer. You know, Gary, my ball always goes at right angles off the tee into the chairman's garden. Could you tell me how? And then Gary says in the next drawing, Ian, I suspect that you are finding it difficult to discover whether you're right-handed or left-handed. And then the third picture shows Gary showing Ian that he is, in fact, neither and better give up golf, or whatever it is. As I say, it's funnier than Garfield. I read it regularly, and my golf does not improve. Now, having apologized... Are you feeling all right, Giles? Giles is the most delightful person to have on the staff because he laughs at the poorest jokes. And it's having a very bad effect on me because until he came onto the staff, no one ever smiled at mine. But now I find it all too easy, and I don't know where that leads. Now, I'm going to say tonight that there is a secret in this important issue of Christian giving. That secret is not actually tithing, though I think that's an important point. And there's a very good book by R.T. Kendall on the bookstall on tithing. And a book like that certainly makes you think. And I hope that as you pass the bookstall, some of you may take that book and read it. But that's not the secret that I have in mind tonight. I've got a secret which I think goes further back than that and actually is even more scriptural. Let me say straight away that I've got great hopes for this talk because these are not my ideas on Christian giving. What I want to introduce you to tonight is one of the very greatest promises in the New Testament on this matter of Christian generosity. It's certainly been the most important verse in the New Testament for me on this subject and has brought me an enormous amount of blessing. So let me make it quite clear at the beginning that I'm not trying to get your money from your pocket and your purse into the coffers of St. Helens. I don't think that you will imagine that I am. In fact, because in the city centre we are so careful never to discuss this matter of money that sometimes the council have said to me, we really must have a talk before 1989 on the subject so that people know what the Bible has to teach. When I first came to preach amongst the city workers, I was determined that we should not follow in what is so often an unfortunate habit of the church of putting out the hat and asking people to give. For what this church has to give in the city is, of course, far greater and more important than what the city has to give to it. And I hope that we've always kept that priority plain. However, I do want to do something for you. I want to bless you. And I wish there were time for me to get people who have been members of our city congregation to stand up here tonight and tell you of the sheer exhilaration and happiness that they have discovered by becoming generous givers. I don't mean simply those who are better off. I mean people who are not particularly well off at all, who have families to keep and only just seem to manage. But it's also true of some in our congregations in the weekday who are much better off, people that you might have thought have explored most of the happinesses that you can find in this life. And yet I think I could find them to stand up here and give their testimony to you that they never found a happiness greater than when they began to give generously. That God blessed them so much. Well, there isn't time for that tonight, but I assure you that is so, because from time to time they have given me the privilege of hearing their testimonies and what they've discovered of God's grace in this regard. Now, so much by way of introduction. Let's turn to the secret. You'll find it in Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 9. 2 Corinthians, chapter 9, and verse 8. And I'm going to read it, first of all, from the old authorized version. Here it is. 2 Corinthians 9:8. God is able, just listen to this before you read, will you? God is able to make all grace abound unto you, that you, having always all sufficiency in everything, may abound unto every good work. Now, I've always thought that that in that particular form, that verse in that particular form, is very frustrating. Because you might honestly wonder what on earth it meant. It seems just to be a blessed, pious thought in rather rich language. I remember that it used to hang as a text above the receptionist office in an important Christian organization in West London. And when I used to go to a committee meeting there, I would pass the receptionist desk, and there was this text. God is able to make all grace abound unto you, that you, having always all sufficiency in everything, may abound unto every good work. I wondered how many people, as they passed that desk, had any idea what that blessed thought was talking about. The impression it gave me when I first read it was that in some way God was promising me help in my need. And I could imagine people coming in rather fraught on the way to a committee, looking at that text and saying, "Oh Lord, thank you that you promised help to get me through this committee when the chairman is such a trial." Or perhaps one of the staff of that organization, most of them Christian workers amongst students, rushing out of the building and looking at that text above the receptionist office, the desk, and saying to themselves, "Well, I can face the meeting now because God has promised to give me all the grace that I need." Actually, it's got nothing to do with God's general offer of help in times of trial and need. It's right down to earth. I know that sometimes Paul does soar off into the heavens, but how here he's got his feet right down on the earth. He's actually here talking about a collection of money that he's making for the poor Christians in Jerusalem. And he's writing at some length through chapter 8 and chapter 9 in detail to the Christians about how he wants them to respond to his appeal and to provide some money. It could not be more down to earth. It's very seldom that Paul takes up a theme like this. Usually he's dealing with some great Christian doctrine or some great piece of Christian ethics in the churches, but here it's very much a matter of the collection. So let's look at it in the Revised Standard Version. The NIV is not much help. I think actually the RSV is probably the most helpful of the modern translations. So will you now look down at your verse, 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 8. And God is able to provide you with every blessing in abundance, so that you may always have enough of everything and may provide in abundance for every good work. God then is able to supply you with abundant means, and by this he means cash, so that you may have enough for yourself and for your dependents, and you may have enough to be abundant giver for good causes and Christian enterprises. Now this verse is a God is able verse. And whenever you come across the three words God is able, the implication is that man is not able. Paul here is talking about something that we shall very quickly regard as humanly impossible. Impossible to believe that we shall have enough for ourselves and our families and enough to be generous givers, especially, perhaps, in days of inflation or great expense or also of unemployment. I was rather helped by Phil Jensen this last weekend when many of us were down at Fairmile. He has a way of saying, after giving a splendid Bible exposition, well, of course, none of you will really believe that. And then your sort of hackles rise, and you say, well, I do believe it. I think it's very helpful to say to people, you don't actually believe this. So I want to say this in advance tonight, that you don't actually believe this verse, and you won't believe it even when I finished. And yet I hope in the end that you will come to believe it. I hope in the end that by the grace of God, you will come to believe that God is able to do these two things in your life. Even when you've faced all the practical realities of the strain of keeping abreast and keeping your bank manager happy. Let me then underline again what it is saying. Will you look at the verse and I'll tell you what it is saying. It says that God is able to do two things. First, to give you yourself enough of everything. The blessing there has to do, as I say, with material means. That you will have enough of everything that money buys for yourself and for your family. That's the first thing that God is able to do. That's a great assurance that follows the teaching of Jesus, doesn't it? That we need not be anxious because he'll supply our needs. But the startling thing is that it goes on from there and says that God is able to give us not only that for ourselves and those who depend upon us, but he's able to provide in abundance for every good work. In other words, he's able to supply my needs sufficiently for me and my family to be able to give generously to all those good causes and Christian enterprises that abound on every hand and of which we've heard so much at a time like Christmas. Now, to get the context of this, I think we'll read the first five verses. We mustn't just take it out, must we, on its own and learn it by heart without seeing where it comes. And I don't know whether you'd caught up with this theme when Paul began to read, but in case not, I'll just read the first five verses. Now, it is superfluous for me to write to you about the offering for the saints, says the apostle, having already made up his mind to write a great deal. For I know your readiness, of which I boast about you to the people of Macedonia, saying that Achaia has been ready since last year, and your zeal has stirred up most of them. But I am sending the brethren. You see, he's not only sending a letter, he's sending some brethren as well. Doesn't sound quite as though he's as sure of them as he says. I am sending the brethren so that our boasting about you may not prove empty in this case, so that you may be ready, as I said you would be. Lest if some Macedonians come with me and find that you're not ready, you're rushing around trying to find this money. It's quite obvious you paid no attention to it and nothing is ready for me. We be humiliated, to say nothing of you, for being so confident. I've cracked you up to the skies. I've told them that you're a most generous church. I've told them that the moment I come, you'll be willing to hand over the check. It'll be very humiliating for you as well as for me, if that's not right. So I thought it necessary to urge the brethren to go on to you before me and arrange in advance for this gift, since I didn't really trust you, although you promised it, so that it may be ready not as an exaction but as a willing gift. Hint, hint. Well, really. I mean, it doesn't sound altogether as sincere as the apostle normally is. And yet, if you know the Corinthian church, you will understand it. For the mark of the Corinthian church was that they were great talkers. They were full of the language of Zion. They were full, I'm sure, of cant. And there are people like that today. And if you've had anything to do with people who are ready at the tip of their tongue to say what the Lord does here and what the Lord does there, you'll know not to trust them in business. You'll know when it actually comes down to the brass tacks that people like that are very difficult to somehow come to terms with. It's often that they've escaped into a fantasy world where they persuade themselves of their spirituality by that kind of talk. At least so it seems with the Corinthians. If you have to send a letter, and then you have to send a group of people ahead of you, and then you have to tell them how you've spoken of them, and then you have to show them your doubts as to whether they'll be ready, it's quite clear that though they were apparently very conscious and conceited about their spiritual standing, Paul did not share their confidence. Now, from verse 6 onwards, it is well worth following the logic of how he goes through. Let us look at it. Because he doesn't simply exhort them and twist their arm, of course. He is Paul the Apostle. We've got to know him by now. If you've been coming to St. Helens, you'll know him. And Paul always gives not just exhortation, but explanation. He always rams in solid teaching. He wants to persuade you. He wants to show you the truth of the matter. So the point is this, verse 6. He who sows sparingly, and this means in terms of generosity, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. That's a great spiritual principle that he's talked out many times, and it's true about money. And so in verse 6, he tells them something which they all know if they know the Bible. I think we'll have a flip back to the reference there. Many of them would be Bible readers. They would see at once that he was referring to something like Proverbs chapter 11, verse 24. Proverbs 11, 24. This is the kind of teaching that a Jewish person was brought up with, didn't always practice, but knew to be the way that God looks at things. Proverbs 11, 25. A liberal man will be enriched, not impoverished, notice. And one who waters will himself be watered. The people curse him who holds back grain, but a blessing is on the head of him who sells it. And then verse 24. One man gives freely, yet grows all the richer. Another withholds what he should give, and only suffers want. That's a striking sentence, isn't it? That verse 24. Perhaps the most striking of that little group of the righteous men. Now, there's a general principle. We are not, of course, to take this so literalistically and crudely that we imagine that the way to become prosperous is to give, that we, so to speak, twist God's arm and say, now I've given, you've got to give me that Rolls Royce I've been coveting. There is a curious kind of teaching along these lines, which apparently is appearing in the United States and also in this country, as though prosperity is the only mark of a faithful Christian. I've sometimes had to say that prosperity is a blessing of the Old Testament. Adversity is the blessing of the New Testament. And though it is that God delights to bless us with prosperity, he does not promise in any crude sense that because we give, we shall automatically get a rise in salary or become a millionaire. I don't think I need make that point, but only against an excessive literalism. Verse 7. Each one of you must do as he's made up his mind, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. That's typical of Paul. He says, I want you to think. Use your mind, not my mind. Don't go by what I say. He says, I don't want it to be a matter of reluctance, nor do I want it to be a compulsory levy. I don't want you to be irritated and annoyed. Now, you know, you can be irritated, can't you, when some people seek to get the money out of your pocket. I can think of a very eloquent sermon I heard in another language. I thought, actually, he was appealing for decisions for Christ. It went on for 20 or 25 minutes. And I leaned over to somebody who knew both languages who was sitting with me on the platform, and I said, what was that about? He said, oh, he's just trying to get money out of their pockets. Now, if you listen to that for 25 minutes, it can be exceedingly irritating, can't it? There are people today who are so professional, so expert, in picturing to you the appalling need and your richness and making you feel guilty, that to pay them off you'd willingly pull out every note in your wallet. Now, Paul is not asking you to pay him off because he's a bully. He says, I want you to be a happy giver, and the Greek word really means a hilarious giver. You ever heard sort of thing? Only Christianity can make it true. Is somebody who finds giving a hilariously joyful matter. So don't let me make up your mind, let every man make up his mind. I want to say that right now. This is up to you, up to you. Verse 10 is a very lovely one. Verse 9 is a quotation from Psalm 112, verse 9, we won't look at now. But verse 10 goes on to explain and further enlarge on verse 8. Explains it a bit more. He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your resources and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in every way for great generosity. So he's going to give you bread, but he's also going to give you not only bread to eat, but seed for another harvest ahead. He's going to enrich you so that you yourself will have enough to meet your proper needs, but also he promises to enrich you so that you may be a greatly generous person. Isn't that lovely? There's the secret of generosity again in verse 11. You will be enriched in every way for great generosity. God delights to work in his children's lives so that people say, my, they're generous. The secret of generosity. Now, at this stage, I want to do what the Apostle Paul does, and I want to give you some incentives. You may have this great promise, but we all need incentives. And so he gives us at least four. They refer to you, God, the needy, and the Christian church. Listen to them, if you will, carefully, because together they make a very impressive list of incentives. Are you doubtful if you want to go on listening to me? Are you doubtful if you want God to prove this ability in your life? Do you think this is all a little bit airy-fairy? Do you doubt if you'll do anything about it tomorrow morning? Let me give you then four incentives. First, you will be blessed. Verse 11a, you will be enriched in every way for great generosity. It is more blessed to give than to receive. Now, this is a great New Testament principle. I wonder sometimes if you've ever found yourself challenged to speak to somebody about Jesus. It may be that that's happened to you only comparatively recently because you're a young Christian. And you've been very reluctant to do it. You've thought of 163.5 reasons why it would be unreasonable for you to talk to that person about Jesus Christ. It may be he's the person who stands the other end of the other side in the dissecting room. And you do your work together and you talk of everything under the sun, but you've never really made it clear to him where you stand or her where you stand, and God seems to have been putting pressure on you. And so at the end, I won't go through all the agonies we all go through at these times, because I think many of us are restrained and shy people. In the end, you blurt out your concern to them and you tell them that you're a Christian and that you'd love to tell them a bit more about it. And surprisingly, perhaps, you find them receptive, and you have a very good talk. And later on that day, you find yourself walking on air. You find that it's been a much greater blessing to you than it's been to them. Why, the garbled theology that you were able to pass over to them may not actually have enlightened them very much. But as for you, you're a new man. You hardly touch the ground all day. Is it not true that when needing great courage from God, we launch out and do something like that, we give some little word of testimony to somebody, which is not particularly brilliant, and somehow God just pours out on us the blessing. So I want to tell you that this is a principle throughout the Christian life. You will be blessed as you bless others. As you speak to others, as you give to others, as you do things for others, as you turn away from yourself to pass on to others what you have, you will find that God pours a blessing upon you. It's a rule of the road in the Christian life. First incentive, you will be enriched. Now, that's not a con, you know. I'm so frightened, aren't you, of con men today? You see, that sounds like a con trick, doesn't it? Now, come on, open your pockets, you'll be blessed. But it isn't a trick. It's true. Second incentive. God will be thanked. God will be thanked. Verse 11. Which through us will produce thanksgiving to God. And again at the end of verse 12. For the rendering of this service not only supplies the wants of the saints, but overflows in many thanksgiving to God. I remember when I was a kid many, many moons ago, we used to take round food. I think it was after Christmas. I can't remember when it was. It was a fairly generous parish, and there was always... Oh, no, this is after harvest. The whole church was groaning with pumpkins and every conceivable thing. And it was my job to take this round to people, and I remember taking it round to the almshouses and knocking on one day and passing in a basket full of all these things. And the door was shut, And I heard the elder, the other side of the door, say, "Thank God." I always remembered that. I thought that visit was worthwhile. Not because she thanked me, but because there was an evident and sincere and heartfelt thankfulness to God as she shut the door and didn't hear, think that I heard her. She was as deaf as a post, I suppose, and therefore when she prayed, everybody in the neighboring houses heard. You will be blessed. God will be thanked. You can't have a greater privilege than that. Third incentive. Ready for it? The needy will have their wants supplied. And that's said very plainly in verse 12, and I hardly need to underline it. How can these needs be supplied unless somebody gives? Oh, I know that we have a welfare state today, and fairly sophisticated means are made, and yet there are all sorts of needs that are still not supplied, aren't there? Especially in terms of things like friendship. The welfare state can't give that, really. You will be blessed. God will be thanked. The needy will have their wants supplied, will be helped. Fourthly, here's your fourth incentive. The church will be strengthened. Now, I ought to tell you that the reason for this collection was not just that the Jerusalem saints had material needs. Many commentators have pointed out that Paul was a great tactician. Paul's great ambition was to bring Jew and Gentile together. Paul longed for the unity of the Christian church, and he used to bend everything to this end. And he saw that the Jews, the Jewish Christians, were very suspicious of these new Gentile Christians. It was very hard for the people of God, the ancient people of God, to believe that Gentiles, the pagans, could come to the same knowledge as they did. And Paul realized that if, because the saints in Jerusalem were poor, if some of the new Gentile Christians could send them a wonderfully generous gift, obviously more than they could afford, the Christians in Jerusalem would sit up and say, well, something must be going on amongst these people. One commentator says this, what the Christians in Jerusalem were inclined to doubt was the reality of Gentile Christianity. Now look at verse 13. You see, this is the meaning of these words. Under the test of this service, you will glorify God by your obedience in acknowledging the gospel of Christ. And by the generosity of your contribution for them and for all others, while they long for you and pray for you because of the surpassing grace of God in you. You see, this is a test. These Gentiles are pretty greedy and covetous. We know that they live for this world and not the next. And yet suddenly we find that they're emptying their pockets and their bank accounts and sending off this marvelously generous gift. And the Jerusalem Christians sit up and say, why, these people are our brothers and sisters. And though we can't send back any money to them, we will pray for them and long to see them. Now, isn't that a marvelous result? That's Paul the tactician. You see, he sees that a two-way traffic will happen if they show this generosity. And I want to say that I think that's still true, that fellowship between Christians is not just a matter, is it, of singing praises together on a Sunday night, shaking hands and saying, who are you? Glad you're here, and so on. Not just a matter of mixing at the time when we do greet each other on a Sunday evening. That real Christian fellowship is enhanced by little practical tokens of proof of our interest and concern. Now, that can't be done, can it? Just by the clergy or the staff team. It's got to be done by all of us, especially with so many people coming here. So we need to clothe our felt concerns in acts. And in that way, the unity of Christians who come and meet with one another here will be made very rich. A letter, for example. A meal left for somebody who needs help at that particular time. A visit. Well, now, let's take this visit that Chris and Debbie have made to the Pathfinder group at St. John's Hoxton. I think St. John's Hoxton really began to wonder whether a privileged church like ours really did care for them. The vicar had written to me a number of times asking for someone to come and help in their Sunday school, but there was little that they seemed to be able to do. You see, to talk about fellowship between Christians if you can't do anything doesn't really cut much ice. And great joy has been caused at St. John's Hoxton just because two of our young people, Debbie and Chris, go along and take a Pathfinder group, and they were only telling me this week how they need another couple. Now that kind of action on a Sunday morning, not coming here on a Sunday morning, coming here back on a Sunday evening to meet your friends and be fed, but going out on a Sunday morning to teach these young people in Hoxton who will very seldom find anybody taking interest in them, that will unify the church, won't it? See, we shan't any longer have this talk in Helen's middle class and John's working class. Nothing in common between them. That kind of talk is very harmful, isn't it? There's no way of curing it, however, except by these practical things. So there are four incentives. They're worth remembering, aren't they? You will be enriched. God will be thanked. The needy will be helped. The church will be strengthened. And then comes the final tremendous punchline. Thanks be to God for his inexpressible gift. Now, I don't think that's just a wonderful expression of what he was feeling. I've said already that the Corinthian church was an unsatisfactory church. They were a church greatly gifted. They saw their gifts as reason for boasting and self-display. They gloried, for example, in their tongues because they said their tongues built themselves up in their own private devotional life. And Paul is weary with that kind of spirituality. He urges upon them to build other people up and not be so concerned and so self-conscious about themselves. He urges them, in other words, not to glory in their gifts because it made them boast about themselves as a church, but to glory in their giving. So you see, the end of verse 15 at the end of the chapter is actually in line with the whole letter. I don't want to hear about your gifts, it's as though the great apostle is saying. I know you've got masses. I want to hear about your giving. Because the way we show the family likeness is by giving. For God, at the very heart of himself, is generous. Now, I've just got 2 minutes. Let me say this. Back to verse 8. May I ask you to do some practical things? Will you start where you are thoughtfully? Be realistic and be sober. Don't go out tomorrow morning, blow the whole of your grant on Operation Mobilization, and then find the rest of the term difficult. Not that there are many students back with us, and I dare say you're above grants. Well, blow then all next month's salary. Start where you are. See what you can afford. Make some kind of system if you haven't. And start to do this in a sober, realistic, practical, regular way. Start where you are. It doesn't matter how small. You can always build up. So start where you are thoughtfully. I know many of you do this, but I just say that to those of you who haven't even thought about this, and you can't start as too young a Christian. Secondly, recognize the terms of God's promise. He says he will give us all sufficiency. That means he will give us enough to be content. It does not mean he will give us enough to meet all our greed, obviously, or all the things that we might like. But he's able to give us sufficiency to be contented Christians. And thirdly, if you wonder if you can launch out into this new life of giving, start being thankful for all the gifts that God has given to you. That's one of the very best ways to do it. And as we start a new year, we're going to look back into the old year and be thankful by saying together the general thanksgiving. And you'll find that in the chorus book, opposite number 81. And at the end of this, at any rate, I hope you will want to say in your heart, thanks be to God for his inexpressible gift. Almighty God, Father of all mercies, we, your unworthy servants, give you our humble and heartfelt thanks for all your goodness and loving kindness to us and to all men. We praise you for our creation, preservation, and all the blessings of this life, but above all for your immeasurable love in the redemption of the world by our Lord Jesus Christ, for the means of grace and for the hope of glory. We pray that you will give us such an awareness of your goodness that our hearts may be truly thankful, and that we may declare your praise not only with our lips, but in our lives, by giving ourselves in your service, and by walking before you in holiness and righteousness all our days. All honor be to you, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, now and through eternity. Amen.